Let's go ahead and continue in 2 Samuel chapter 7, where we began yesterday as we closed, a conversation that took place between David and a counselor of his, Nathan the prophet, sometime shortly after he had brought the Ark of the Covenant to the new capital city of Jerusalem and put it in a special dedicated area of the palace, underneath a tent, and that's going to come up in the conversation. So picture David sitting in his very fine palace, a gift from the Phoenician government to himself, smelling the smell of this fresh wood paneling and seeing the intricate carvings everywhere, sitting on his nice throne. And this is what happens. Now, when the king lived in his house, and he who is had given him rest from all his surrounding enemies, that is, from the Philistines that were beat shortly before the Ark of the Covenant was successfully brought, the king said to Nathan the prophet, "See now, I live in a house of cedar, but the Ark of God dwells in a tent." So you can hear what's bothering him is he's got this nice permanent place, very well-appointed, and the Ark of God is basically under canvas. It's underneath a tent, awning. So Nathan, without checking in with God, he just expresses what's on his own heart. Nathan said to the king, "Go, do all that is in your heart, for he who is with you." So Nathan just says, "David, if you want to build a permanent temple for the Ark of God, for God's throne, you go for it. God will be on your side." Now, he finds out that he spoke too soon. Because that same night, verse 4 says, the word of he who is came to Nathan. "Go and tell my servant David, thus says he who is." Now we'll get into the details of that in just a moment. First, let's deal with the fact that Nathan had good intentions. He really did believe that God was on David's side for anything that he wanted to do at this point, including building a temple for the Ark of God. But Nathan was wrong. And so God corrects him and gives him the responsibility of going and correcting his statement to David, to tell David what God has to say on this particular topic, not what Nathan thinks. And that's very, very important, particularly for those of us who are preachers, that we need to distinguish between what the Word of God clearly says and what our opinion might be on a particular topic, and never let the two be mixed together. Make it very, very clear. Thus says the Lord, or thus says Thomas. Verse number 5 continues. Here's God's message to David. "Would you build me a house to dwell in?" So, you think that I want you to build me a house right this moment, a palace. Verse 6, "I have not lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this day, but I have been moving about in a tent for my dwelling." Now, understand, this is speaking of appearances. The Ark of God represents the throne of God on earth. Now, God is not contained to any one location on planet earth. But for the symbolic sake of the Israelis, the Ark of the Covenant represents the seat of God's power. It's not an idol. It's just simply a physical touch point, a physical focal point for the Israelis. That's it. And so God says, "Look, my ark has been traveling around in the tabernacle ever since it was first built. Verse 7, in all the places where I have moved with all the people of Israel, did I speak a word with any of the judges of Israel whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? So he wants Nathan to get David to think back through history. Is there any time at which God said to any of the judges, hey, how come you haven't built a permanent palace for God, a temple for the Ark of the Covenant? Didn't happen. Verse number 8. Now, therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says Yahweh Tzabaoth. Now, that's the Hebrew. So, he who is over the armies. I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, that you should be prince over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you went, and I have cut off all your enemies from before you. So here is God going over David's history now. So David is somewhere just past his 8th year on the throne. So he's somewhere around 38 or older as this event takes place. And David was a shepherd up until that day that he was anointed by God's command by Samuel. That would have been when he was about 12. So he's come a long way in the decades since he was a kid chasing after his father's flocks and goats, his sheep and his goats. And God has given him great military victories since then. And that's important to one of the reasons he's not going to be allowed to build God's temple. And this is where we need to bring something in from David's testimony later. When he is talking to the leadership and to his son Solomon, and about his son Solomon, who's going to build the temple. David, in 1 Chronicles chapter number 28, said this in verse 2, I had it in my heart to build a house of rest for the Ark of the Covenant of He Who Is, and for the footstool of our God. And I made preparations for building. But God said to me, you may not build a house for my name, for you are a man of war and have shed blood. So God told David at the time that we're looking at right now, in 2 Samuel chapter 7 and 1 Chronicles chapter 17, that he was not going to be allowed to build the temple, in part because God used him as a sword against the enemies of Israel, that David had personally killed lots of people. He had shed a lot of blood. And God was going to want any temple dedicated to him to be built by someone who had never fought in a war, to make it a building of peace. So keep that kind of in the context, David's testimony about some other things that God told him at the same time we're looking at here. So back to 2 Samuel 7, 9. I've been with you wherever you went. I've cut off all your enemies from before you. So I helped you in your wars. And I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them so that they may dwell in their own place and be disturbed no more. Now, at this juncture, it seems that God is telling the larger story of Israel that includes the far future, a future beyond where we're at, the future of the millennium, when Israel will be in the land, that is the righteous Israel, will be in the land, those that have called upon the name of the Lord and who are saved, and they will never, ever be disturbed again. Now, that is not true in biblical history. Israel, after David was told these things, had plenty of times that they were disturbed, and a couple of times that they were kicked out of the land at God's judgment. But there is coming a time under the throne of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, Jesus himself, that this will be true. So keep this as a messianic millennial passage for prophetic fulfillment. So they will be disturbed no more, and violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly. From the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel, and I will give you rest from all your enemies. So that's all ultimate future, millennial passage. Back to the wording to David. Moreover, he who is declares to you that he who is will make you a house. Now there's some play on words here. We're talking about a physical house, a palace, that David wants to build that God won't let him. And then God says, I'm going to build you a house of a family. That's going to be very important. Verse 12, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, other words, you die, I will raise up your offspring after you who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. Now, this is one of those double prophecies. It's got a near component and a distant component. The distant component is about Jesus, because he is a direct descendant of David, and he will be the seed of his body that will rule and reign over the kingdom forever. And he is also the one that will build up a house of believers, a house made of living stones, with himself being the chief capstone. So there's a prophecy here about Jesus, but there is also a prophecy here about Solomon, who is still several years away from being born. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So Solomon is going to be building a physical palace for God, the temple. And his throne, that is the throne of Israel, reigned on by David, then Solomon, and then Rehoboam, and forward in time. That throne is going to be established forever. So this dynasty of David will be an everlasting dynasty. That's what God promises. Verse 14, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. So we've still got the idea of the double components. God is the father of Jesus. Jesus is the son of God. Solomon is the son of the father. That is, he is God's son seated upon the throne of Israel. And that is the way that kings are looked at in Israel. They are representatives of God. Now, the next part is only about Solomon and those who follow him on the throne of Israel as his offspring. When he commits iniquity, because that's not true about Jesus, when he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men, but my steadfast love will not depart from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. So the promise here is, I will discipline future descendants of you, David, but I will never terminate your dynasty like I terminated the dynasty of Saul, took him off of the throne. Verse 16, your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. So the promise of God is the Davidic line will be the line of royalty for Israel. Now, Jesus is the climax of that. Once Jesus takes the throne, there is no need for additional offspring. The dynasty will be eternal in him. Verse number 17, in accordance with all these words and in accordance with all this vision, Nathan spoke to David. So Nathan comes back the next day, says, David, I have to apologize to you. Now, this is my imagination, right? I have to apologize to you. I spoke too soon. God let me know last night that you are not going to be allowed to build the temple. You are a man of war. You have shed much blood. And it's going to be built, a temple is going to be built by someone that doesn't have that in their life. And then he gives him the rest of the news that the dynasty is going to be permanent and that it's going to be an important part of the history of Israel. So David soaks up all that information, and even though he's no doubt disappointed that he doesn't get to build the temple that he wanted to build, he is thankful for God's blessing in his life. And so he composes a prayer of thanks to God. Verse number 18, King David went in and sat before he who is. Now, I imagine that what this means is that he went into the tent where the Ark of the Covenant is located and sat down and began to pray. And he said, who am I, O he who is my master? What is my house that you've brought me thus far? And yet this was a small thing in your eyes, O he who is my master. What you see here is a unique combination of Adonai and Yahweh, the divine name and the name that means my master. And you can see it in the formatting here. You see God is capital letter G and a slightly lower font size of capital letter O, capital letter D. That represents the divine name. And then Lord here represents the Hebrew word Adonai. So check your own version of the Bible, the foreword. It'll explain to you how the translators deal with different combinations of the divine name. All right, so this was a small thing in your eyes, O he who is my master. You have spoken also of your servant's house for a great while to come. So you've told me all about the future. And this is instruction for mankind, O he who is my master. And what can David say to you? For you know your servant, O he who is my master. Because of your promise and according to your own heart, you have brought about all this greatness to make your servant know it. Therefore, you are great, O he who is God. For there is none like you. There is no God besides you. And according to all that we have heard with our ears, and who is like your people Israel, the one nation on earth whom God went to redeem to be his people, making himself a name and doing for them great and awesome things by driving out before your people whom you redeemed for yourself from Egypt, a nation and its gods. So he starts going back over history again, thanking God for not just simply choosing his family and telling him things that go clear way high into the future, but also for the fact that God redeemed the nation of Israel out of Egypt several hundred years earlier and brought them into the promised land, kicked out the Canaanites that were there and defeated not just the Canaanites, but their gods, because there is no God but he who is. Verse 24, and you establish for yourself your people Israel to be your people forever. And you, O he who is, became their God. So relationship. That's what he's praising God about. Relationship personally between himself and God, but also between God and the people that David is going to serve as king. And now, O he who is God, confirm forever the word that you've spoken concerning your servant and concerning his house, and do as you have spoken. Excuse me. So David says, please keep your promise. Make sure that my dynasty goes on into eternity. Verse 26, and your name will be magnified forever, saying, he who is over the armies is God over Israel. And the house of your servant David will be established before you. For you, O he who is over the armies, the God of Israel, have made this revelation to your servant, saying, I will build you a house. And therefore, your servant has found courage to pray this prayer to you. And now, O he who is God, you are God, and your words are true, and you have promised this good thing to your servant. Now, therefore, may it please you to bless the house of your servant so that it may continue forever before you. For you, O he who is my master, have spoken, and with your blessing shall the house of your servant be blessed forever. So David offers this thanksgiving prayer, thanking God for affirming that his dynasty will last into eternity, affirming that David's desire to have a temple built to God will be carried out by a future offspring of his, and that the people of Israel will have God as their God. So everything is looking good. David probably at this moment starts planning that I will do what I can to help my son, whoever that son is going to be, to build this palace, this temple to God, whenever the time does come after my death. So he will really kick up those preparations for the building of the temple after the birth of the son that will do it. That is Solomon. He doesn't understand it at this point because it's still future history to him. But the sons that are little kids right now, none of them are going to be permitted to build the temple. They will have their own issues. Some of them will die at the hands of others, and then themselves come under the judgment of God. It will be a much later born son. The second son born in a relationship that should not have happened, that will end up being the builder of the temple. Now, until then, David focuses on his job as the king to keep his borders secure and to make sure that Israel can occupy the promised land as God told them to. So the beginning of chapter number 8, where we're going to kind of finish up today, is a catalog of various military campaigns that David carries out somewhere around this time in his kingdom, after he has taken over a new capital city and brought the Ark of God there. So chapter 8 of 2 Samuel, after this, David defeated the Philistines and subdued them. And David took Methag Ammah out of the hands of the Philistines. Now, this is just a certain place, one of the chief cities, apparently, of the Philistines. So the Philistines have been a problem making border incursions quite a bit. Up until this point, David now makes them behave themselves. Now, he doesn't eradicate them because they are not Canaanites. So they are not under the judgment of God. Verse number 2. He defeated Moab. Now, Moab had been a kind of an ally of his to begin with, and then they kind of go out of favor with him, and then he brings them back into line again. So he defeated Moab and measured them with a line, making them lie down on the ground. Two lines he measured to be put to death, and one full line to be spared. And the Moabites became servants to David and brought tribute. Now we'll have to develop this a little bit more later, but this seems to be in reference to a surprise attack that the Moabites carried out against David and did great damage and harm. And David's response was to punish them severely. So 2/3 of the people that attacked were executed, and 1/3 of them were spared to go back to their homes and pay tribute. And so it's all because of their attack on Israel that happened. And then David turned his attention northward. It says David also defeated Hadadezer, the king, or the son of Rehob, king of Zobah, as he went to restore his power at the river Euphrates. So that's the northern territories up past Dan that David feels are being aggressive toward Israel. And so he takes the fight to them. And then they kind of try to form an alliance against David, and David just continues to defeat them. And we'll have to come back and continue this catalog of military victories tomorrow.